The following program contains words that will be offensive to some listeners. Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. Today, I'll have readings from the Chicago Sun-Times, the Washington Post. I'll have several stories from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, two of which are about legendary female entertainers. And I'm going to start with this story about college athletes from Fortune magazine. The title is, NAACP Urges Student Athletes to Reconsider Florida Colleges Over Rampant Anti-Black Policies After State Eliminates DEI Programs. It was written by Mark Long and published March 12, 2024. Black student athletes should reconsider attending public colleges and universities in Florida, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People said in a letter to the National Collegiate Athletic Association president Charlie Baker on Monday. The letter was in response to the University of Florida and other state schools that have eliminated their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. It was also addressed to current and prospective student athletes. "This is not about politics," the letter read. "It's about the protection of our community, the progression of our culture, and most of all, it's about your education and your future." The letter was signed by NAACP National Board of Directors Chairman Leon Russell and NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson. Last year, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill prohibiting the use of state funds for any DEI programs. The University of Florida responded in March by closing the office of the Chief Diversity Officer, eliminating 13 full-time DEI positions and 15 administrative appointments, and ending DEI-focused contracts with outside vendors. Other state schools like North Florida and Florida International also have shut down DEI programs. "While it is our duty to spread awareness and encourage action around these egregious assaults, we also recognize that protests can come at a price," the letter read. "The sad reality is, for many black student athletes, collegiate sports may be their sole opportunity at achieving the upward mobility necessary to propel them into their rightful places in society. It's unclear how awareness of the debate over DEI might affect current or prospective student athletes who are considering powerhouses like Florida and Florida State, especially at a time when name, image, and likeness deals have become so integral to building rosters. But a growing campaign could hinder those schools' recruiting efforts." National Football League Hall of Famer and Florida legend Emmitt Smith asked minority athletes at his alma mater to be aware and vocal about the decision. Johnson took it a step further Monday. "Florida's rampant anti-black policies are a direct threat to the advancement of our young people and their ability to compete in a global economy," Johnson said in a statement. "Diversity, equity, and inclusion are paramount to ensuring equitable and effective educational outcomes. The value black and other college athletes bring to large universities is unmatched. If these institutions are unable to completely invest in those athletes, it's time they take their talents elsewhere." That was the Fortune magazine article titled, "NAACP Urges Student Athletes to Reconsider Florida Colleges Over Rampant Anti-Black Policies After State Eliminates DEI Programs." It was written by Mark Long and published March 12, 2024. My next story is from the Chicago area, and it's about someone who's not in the news as much as he used to be. The title is, "Rainbow Push Leader's Quick Exit Underscores Challenge of Following Reverend Jackson. It's the Most Difficult Job in Black America." This appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper and was written by Mitchell Armentrout on April 18, 2024. The abrupt resignation of a Dallas pastor after less than 3 months as head of the Rainbow Push Coalition underscores how daunting a task it'll be for anyone to carry the mantle of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, longtime confidants of the civil rights standard bearer told the Sun-Times. It's still not clear why the Reverend Frederick Haynes III suddenly resigned Tuesday, April 16th, as president of the legendary Southside Social Justice Organization, whose reach, thanks to Jackson, has extended worldwide for decades. But former Rainbow Push insiders and longtime allies of the coalition agreed Haynes' short-lived appointment was hamstrung from the beginning by a split commitment with his Texas megachurch, and it raises more questions about the future of the organization. For Haynes to be here and there, it was impossible, said Hermine Hartman, founder of the Black Chicago publication Indigo, spell N-D-I-G-O. She worked alongside Jackson in the 1960s at Operation Breadbasket, a precursor to the groups that would become Rainbow Push. To fill Reverend Jackson's shoes requires a person who can do multiple things at the same time, raise money, stay on top of the issues, be political, and act as caretaker for communities worldwide, Hartman said. He was trained by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We're talking about rare people, masterminds. She called Haynes a brilliant minister, but he may not have been the right person to carry the movement. Haynes, pastor of Friendship West Baptist Church in Dallas, was formally installed as president of Rainbow Push in February, though Jackson, 82, named him his successor last summer. In a brief statement, Haynes announced his immediate resignation after continued prayer and deliberation. I remain committed to honoring the rich history of RPC and the legacy of its esteemed leader, the incomparable Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, Sr., and most significantly, to the calling and pursuit of social justice, Haynes said. I extend my heartfelt gratitude to all who have expressed their support since my appointment in July of last year. Rest assured that my work in the fight for liberation and freedom continues. Haynes couldn't be reached directly for comment. Sources close to Rainbow Push leadership said his resignation caught the organization by surprise. Reached by phone, Jackson called Haynes a fantastic preacher and reiterated a statement released by the coalition accepting his resignation. We're grateful to Reverend Haynes for his service and leadership, continuing the work of our founder and president emeritus, Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, Sr., coalition leader said. We remain eternal partners in the fight for peace, civil rights, and economic justice. Rainbow Push leaders didn't respond to further questions about the search for a new president. Jackson's son, Yusef Jackson, serves as chief operating officer. He couldn't be reached for comment, nor could the Reverend's other sons, Representative Jonathan Jackson and ex-Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., who have both held prominent roles with the group. Veteran political strategist Delmari Cobb, a top advisor to Reverend Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign, said it would be difficult for any new leader to meet the standards set by the coalition's founder, who continues to make public appearances as he battles Parkinson's disease. He's still on a mission. Unless you bring in someone with that commitment, they're never going to live up to what he's been able to accomplish, Cobb said, adding that the decision to hand the reins to an out-of-towner was fraught with problems from the beginning. Chicago is unique in its politics. You have to be able to understand that landscape and navigate it. One reason Reverend Jackson was successful navigating situations internationally is because Chicago is a microcosm of everything you'll deal with on a global level, she said. That probably was a hindrance to Freddie ever getting roots in the organization. Public relations executive Jerry Thomas, a former advisor and strategist for Jackson at Rainbow Push, said people underestimate the demands of being the face of the organization and its driving force behind the scenes. It's the most difficult job in Black America, he said. You might be the best preacher or the best politician or activist, but this man could do it all. That includes serving as chief fundraiser for a group that has hit tough financial straits in recent years, according to sources close to Rainbow Push and federal records. The Citizenship Education Fund, a tax-exempt nonprofit affiliated with the coalition, has reported revenue declines since 2020, with an operating loss of more than $620,000 in 2022. When I look at Push right now, I don't know who can ever replace him. I don't see it on the horizon, Thomas said. I think he's the last we'll see in that line of work in the social justice movement. The Reverend Michael Flager of St. Sabina Church said the group can find its next leader in the city. We have plenty of great talent in Chicago, and we can't let Rainbow Push crumble. Reverend Jackson has put in way too much sacrifice over all these years for that to happen, Flager said. We have never needed voices for civil rights and justice as much as we do right now. That was the article titled, Rainbow Push Leader's Quick Exit Underscores the Challenge of Following Reverend Jackson. It's the Most Difficult Job in Black America. It was written by Mitchell Armantrout, published April 18, 2024, and it appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper. Next on today's African American Hour is an article from the WashingtonPost.com website titled, What O.J. Simpson Meant to Black America. It was written by Emmanuel Felton and Rachel Hatzipanagos. It was published April 11, 2024. Nearly 30 years later, O.J. Simpson's arrest and murder trial in Los Angeles still evokes strong memories. There was the glove, the Bronco chase, the minute-by-minute national television coverage. And for many Americans, Simpson's case will also be remembered for how it exposed the deep divisions between black and white Americans. The nation's view of his 1995 acquittal for the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and a friend, Ronald Goldman, largely cleaved along racial lines, though time has bridged some of the gap. Simpson died on April 10th at 76 years old. Coming just a few years after the acquittal of four officers who beat black motorist Rodney King in 1992 and the 1991 killing of black teenager Latasha Harlins by a store clerk in Los Angeles, Simpson's treatment by the police and media was viewed by many in the black community as proof that even wealthy celebrities couldn't escape racism in America, said Amaklar Shabazz, a professor of Afro-American studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. When the verdict was reached, we had one side of the screen with white people crestfallen and crying, and then we had on the other side of the screen black people jumping up and down for joy, said Shabazz. Those racial divisions remain, he said. It's because we haven't replaced the social fabric in a way that we like to pretend we have, because we fall back on race and racism at the drop of a hat or at a drop of the glove, in this case, Shabazz said. While the reaction to the verdict was largely portrayed in the media along racial lines at the time, it was always more complicated than that, said James Lance Taylor, a politics professor at the University of San Francisco. The truth is, many millions of black people thought O.J. Simpson was probably guilty, said Taylor. There was just so much wrapped up in the O.J. case that was connected to the black experience in America. 20 years after the verdict, a 2015 Washington Post ABC News poll showed black Americans were less likely to believe Simpson was guilty compared to white Americans, though by 2007 the gap had started to narrow. In 1997, 31% of black Americans said they were definitely or probably sure of Simpson's guilt. By 2015, that share had risen to 57%. In comparison, 83% of white Americans said Simpson was guilty in 2015, about the same share as held that position in 1997. It's not that black people have changed their minds about Simpson's innocence, Taylor said. I think in the barbershops today, black people are saying, he got away with it, but the police got away with killing a lot more of us, said Taylor. That's the mentality. Taylor was living in Los Angeles at the time of the murders and said he remembers the day that Simpson led police on a car chase and how tens of thousands of people, including many white people, lined the streets and highways yelling, Go O.J. Go! But far before the trial, many black Americans already felt that Simpson had turned his back on the black community, Taylor said, noting that he reportedly liked to tell friends, I'm not black, I'm O.J. Local police prepared for riots as Simpson was convicted, Taylor said. But black people didn't love O.J. like that. This wasn't about O.J. the person, he said. O.J. was just an extension of the general polarization between black America and law enforcement. The sympathy for O.J. is not as deep as we think it is in the black community, Taylor said. Kevin B. Blackstone, ESPN panelist and professor of the practice at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland, wrote in a 2016 Washington Post column, Simpson didn't transcend his race. He escaped it like it was a would-be tackler. He came from the black working poor side of town, but his athleticism trumped that and landed him in an exclusive white university in Los Angeles. Every black celebrity knows that, whether they like it or not, they represent the entire black community. NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter on Thursday, sadly, despite admirable accomplishments as an athlete, O.J. Simpson was not able to live up to that responsibility. Reverend Amos Brown of San Francisco's Third Baptist Church, a longtime friend of Eunice Simpson, Simpson's mother, said it's difficult for him to disentangle the football star's crimes from the challenges he faced, including the ever-present threat of violence in his neighborhood growing up. O.J. Simpson and far too many young black males to this day have been met with attitudes and practices that define them as being less than human, he said. Simpson was introduced to a new audience in 2016 when two television series about the former running back captivated a generation too young to have known him as a Heisman Trophy winner and one of the most recognizable personalities in the country. Philip Lamar Cunningham, an assistant professor of media studies at Wake Forest University, said many of his students view Simpson as a true crime figure rather than the athlete he remembers. Cunningham, who was a young man during the trial, said that he still struggles with the not guilty verdict. Just like everybody else, I had to wrestle with the reality that he very well may have done it, alongside the fact that he is this black man who had for all intents and purposes made it, Cunningham said. Los Angeles was a powder keg at the time of Simpson's trial, still reeling from the Rodney King acquittal and other racially diverse cases, said Mark Watts, who covered the Simpson trial for CNN and is currently the chief brand officer for the African American Leadership Forum. Many African Americans believe that O.J. Simpson was the revenge verdict, Watts said. It was the one black people had won in response to some of the ones black people had lost. For many black people, the trial turned on the testimony of investigating detective Mark Furman, who denied using a racial profanity on the witness stand, Watts said. Simpson's defense team produced audio tapes of Furman using the word multiple times, and Furman later pleaded no contest to committing perjury during the trial. He couldn't be immediately reached for comment. That was the day I felt the jury, which was predominantly African American, pretty much bought the idea from the Dream Team that Furman was a racist, rogue, white cop, Watts said. Watts said he will never forget the day of the verdict, October 3, 1995, when he stood on risers outside of the Los Angeles courthouse and heard the roar of the crowd gathered outside with the media. When he arrived home that evening, he watched news footage of joyous black Americans and frustrated white Americans reacting to the verdict. It showed us even back then that our country was tragically racially polarized. And that is still true today, Watts said. That was the article titled, What O.J. Simpson Meant to Black America. It was written by Emmanuel Felton and Rachel Hatzopanagos. It was published April 11, 2024 at the WashingtonPost.com website. Next on today's African American Hour is a story out of the Atlanta, Georgia area about some men who like doing what I'm doing right now, reading. The title is Fraternity Builds Bonds with School Books. It was written by Ozzy Birdsell and published April 7, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, Organization Goes All Out to Help Boost Literacy by Visiting Classrooms to Read to and Inspire Young Students. There were some unfamiliar faces at Asa G. Hilliard Elementary School when classes began Wednesday, April 3rd. The visitors sat in front of each classroom in the East Point School, flipping through books, reading to the students. The guest readers were members of the Omicron Phi Lambda chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. The visit is part of a burgeoning effort to help raise literacy rates among black grade school students as part of its Literacy Takeover Day. 23 members of the fraternity visited each classroom reading from Keep Dreaming, Black Child by Nyasha Williams and I Am Every Good Thing by Derek Barnes. The kids absolutely love seeing visitors come in. They were actually surprised this morning. It wasn't something they were prepared for, so they were extra excited. Hilliard's principal, Tiambi Walker, said, We want our students to see as much as they can and experience as much as they can. The fraternity members visited children as young as kindergartners and spoke with them about their life goals and aspirations while discussing the value of dreams and finding inspiration. The books were inspiring, uplifting books that enforce positivity and reinforce the idea of achievement as you get older. That's our purpose when we go into the community to elevate particularly young people, said Curtis Bunn, a fraternity member and organizer of the Literacy Takeover Day. Bunn, an author, is the founder of the National Book Club Conference, which exposes audiences to Black writers. He said this effort directly connects to one of Alpha Phi Alpha's signature national programs, Go to High School, Go to College. Established in 1922, the program aims to provide resources and environments that encourage Black students to enroll in college and pursue higher education as a means for success. Alpha Phi Alpha, founded in 1906, is the first intercollegiate Greek letter fraternity established for African American men. For the fraternity members, this is not solely about literacy. It's about being present in the lives of students who don't see many people who look like them and inspiring the students to excel academically. Just 2% of U.S. teachers are Black men, according to federal estimates. At ACG Hilliard, 86% of the students last year were Black, state data shows. Some research shows that Black students assigned to Black teachers are more likely to graduate from high school and enroll in college. In recent years, in response to concerns about Black students struggling in the classroom, more Black men in Georgia and other states have organized activities in schools to support students. In January, for example, 100 Black men of Douglasville, Georgia, welcome new Manchester Elementary School students with high fives on the 100th day of school to show students examples of men living and working in their own community. The Fulton County School District was mentoring partnerships with more than a dozen organizations aimed at supporting Black students. Most work in middle or high schools. Pierre Gaither, president of the Omicron Phi Lambda chapter, said they are also working with schools across Fulton County, such as Fulton Leadership Academy, Westlake High School, and others. He said their goal is to continue developing relationships with school districts and students to bring positive Black representation to grade school students across the state. Being visible is very important. We understand that as an organization based around community involvement, it's important not to just be involved financially, but to be present and show your presence to the kids in the community, said Jermaine White, a member of the fraternity. Walker, Hilliard's principal, said having the fraternity and other community leaders visit students in the school is important in establishing relatable representations for students. I always think about our students being able to see someone that looks like them, she said. Walker is a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated. She said her connection with Alpha Phi Alpha opens the door for consistent and meaningful relationships with students and creating passions for literacy and education. We have engineers, we have designers, we have people who are great in math. We're using all of our collected resources to show kids and show the youth. You can also do these things too, White said. That was the article titled, Fraternity Builds Bonds with School Books. It was written by Ozzie Birdsdale and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, April 7th, 2024. My next reading is from a series of Black History Month articles published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper this year. The 2024 theme for Black History Month dealt with the impact of Afro-Americans in the arts. My next story is titled, Queen of Salsa Has Lasting Legacy. Celia Cruz helped popularize Afro-Caribbean rhythms and Spanish-language music. It was written by Lautaro Grinspan and published February 10, 2024, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. For most, Celia Cruz is a timeless icon with one of music history's most inimitable voices. For South Fulton's Linda Becquer Brichette, she's just Tia. Long before she became a councilwoman in South Fulton, the metro area town with the highest proportion of Black residents, Becquire Pritchett grew up in a three-story house in Queens, New York, with her Cuban family. The top floor was occupied by Cruz, the Havana-born singer who would go on to reach the most improbable heights of artistic success while in exile, making a name for herself around the world as the Queen of Salsa. "She's been my whole life," Becquire Pritchett, the daughter of Cruz's younger sister Gladys, said. As Cruz's number of records sold approached and then crossed the 10 million mark, the accolades multiplied. There were the Grammy Awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award. There was the Smithsonian exhibit, the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and the bestowment of the National Medal of Arts by President Bill Clinton. Later this year, a joyous depiction of Cruz will grace a special edition of the U.S. Quarter. When Becquire Pritchett thinks of her aunt, the most vivid memory is how she made people feel, especially other members of the Afro-Latino community, which has long grappled with a lack of representation and visibility. "For our community, the Afro-Latino community, she gave them a sense of pride," Becquire Pritchett said. "She was kind of like the ambassador for all Latino people of color. There was no replacement for Celia." Becquire Pritchett credits the strength of Cruz's connection with her audience to her unwavering embrace of her roots, including the African rhythms that permeated her music since her earliest days as a performer in Havana, where she made history as the first black lead female singer of one of Cuba's most popular orchestras, La Sonora Matancera. Although she wound up living most of her life in the United States, and according to Becquire Pritchett, spoke much better English than she let on, her work was always Spanish only. "She stood with her market, which was providing music for her people," Becquire Pritchett said. Still, the force and charisma of Cruz's talent transcended the Hispanic or Spanish-speaking community. Non-Latin black artists who have said they were influenced by Cruz include the poet Maya Angelou. Legendary singer Patti LaBelle collaborated with Cruz and also sang at her funeral in 2003. Although Cruz's deliciously catchy cry of "Azuka," sugar, was born out of an interaction with a Miami waiter, many have found significance in its connection to the history of black people in Cuba who are brought as slaves to the island to work its sugar fields. References to Cruz's black pride can be found throughout her oeuvre. One of her last hit songs, released in 2001 just weeks before her 76th birthday, was called "La Negra Tiene Tumbao," which roughly translates to "The Black Lady's Got Style." Latin music is in a boom of mainstream popularity both around the world and in the U.S. Puerto Rican star Bad Bunny has become a fixture among the top streaming charts with music that makes no concessions to English language pop audiences. In 2023, artists like Shakira, Karol G, Peso Pluma, and Grupo Frontera all joined Bad Bunny in scoring top 10 hits in Spanish on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. It's difficult to think Latin music could grow as commercially imposing as it has in the United States without the trailblaze by Cruz and others in decades past, who brought rhythms like salsa from the fringes to the fore. Latin music's current mass appeal is also indebted to the African diaspora, given the influence of rap and reggaeton, a music genre of Afro-Panamanian roots in much of today's hit Spanish language music. Reflecting those broader cultural changes around the country, Latin music has gradually carved out a spot for itself in Atlanta nightlife. In 2016, a group of friends created a monthly dance party called La Cholateca that would go on to become a popular and vibrant gathering spot for the metro area's Hispanic community. A desire to showcase the range and diversity of Latin music was also a goal behind Oye Fest. Since launching in 2018, the yearly festival has strived to give a platform to artists who hail from Atlanta's local Hispanic community. "Our role is to keep providing those opportunities for people to embrace their heritage," said Randall Ruiz, the festival's co-founder, who noted that Cruz served as the blueprint for many of the Latin artists popular today. Josephine Figueroa, a co-founder of La Choloteca, said an important component of Cruz's legacy is that she made Latin music audiences fall in love with a proudly Afro-Cuban woman at a time when racial biases were still very real in Latin America. For Hispanic immigrants in the United States, She also brought joy and a sense of hope that sweetened the bitter journey of migration, Figueroa said. I truly believe that her final albums were odes to the many migrant families coming to the U.S. and building new lives and new futures, she added. That was the article titled, Queen of Salsa Has Lasting Legacy. Celia Cruz helped popularize Afro-Caribbean rhythms and Spanish language music. It was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on February 10, 2024, and written by Lataro Grinspan. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner. Next on today's African American Hour, I have a story about a singer who was known for her vulgar and risque performances. The title is Unapologetically Outspoken, Music Legend Millie Jackson. This appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Sunday, April 7th, 2024, and it was written by Ernie Suggs. The subtitle is Georgia Native Built a Career That Spanned Decades with Live Shows, Risque Humor, and Provocative Album Covers. I started with a simple question. What is a typical day like in the life of Millie Jackson? The music legend, a sonic force who somehow is a cross between Sarah Vaughan and Red Fox, sits at her kitchen table cluttered with mail and picks up a cup of coffee. She doesn't answer the question. She just stares at me as she sips the coffee, its hazelnut aroma filling the kitchen of her stately Southwest Atlanta home. She bats her eyes and licks her lips to savor the taste while I uncomfortably scribble nonsense on my pad and avert my eyes. I ask again. She takes another sip. I just finished, she said, bursting into laughter. This is my day. Her daughter, sitting in the corner of the room, laughs, and I get it. The way she looked at me, teased me. The way she held the joke and played on my insecurities. The way she delivered the punchline at just the right moment. Growing up, I was too young to fully understand the magnitude of Millie Jackson. Sure, I noticed her provocative album covers and sneaked to listen to some of her work, especially the live stuff, but then and now, Jackson always seemed too mature for me. Her albums were played late at night, when the kids had gone to bed, the liquor was flowing, and the card table was set up. In the wide universe of soul and R&B divas who dominated the 1970s, there was no one like Millie Jackson. She wasn't the most popular singer, and she didn't have the best voice. She didn't get much radio play because her lyrics were so explicit, but her live performances were legendary. Jackson growled at her shows and stalked the stage like a panther, or better yet, a cougar. Her lyrics were raw and edgy. She would sweat and grind. She talked about sex. A lot. And she cursed. Lord knows she cursed. She received 2 Grammy nominations for her stunning cover of the Luther Ingram hit, If Loving You Is Wrong, I Don't Want to Be Right, which she would do live for 20 minutes if the mood hit her. But she also had a song which she called a symphony, in which every word was a curse. And it was brilliant. She was naughty and nasty, yet classy and dignified. And as early as the 1960s, she developed a pattern in her songs considered by many to be a precursor to rap. Jackson is the most perfect example of black famous, a condition popularized by author and cultural critic Michael Harriet to explain the gap between black stardom and white anonymity. A person becomes black famous when most black people know their name and face, but white people often have no clue. Think Maze featuring Frankie Beverly. But Jackson, who grew up in rural Georgia, was a phenomenon who built a career on a combination of old-school singing and uncompromising style. In her 6 decades of making music, she has toured the world, racked up 3 gold albums, been nominated for Grammys, sold out arenas, and been inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame. But she hasn't been featured in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution before now. She was amused when I told her that this profile was going to be in the Sunday paper. Church folks are going to lose their minds, she said, laughing. At 79, Jackson still is sharp, funny, and confident enough in her sexuality to tastefully flaunt it. The next section of the article is titled, I Don't Have to Sing. I was a bit nervous meeting Jackson. Her persona is so big that I didn't know what to expect. When I arrived at her home, she answered the door dressed in a pair of sweatpants and a baggy sweatshirt. She offered me coffee and food and complimented my Jordans. Sitting at her kitchen table, she looked like the doting grandmother she is. I expressed my condolences for the long-ago passing of her ex-husband, to whom she was married for less than a year. Why? She deadpanned. I asked her if she plans on getting remarried. I am 79 now, okay? I'm not interested in bringing another man in here because he would only be watching TV. Not me, Jackson said. Throughout our conversation, she often broke out in song to make a point. When talking about her finances, she sings, You can buy you some dirt. There will never be no more. Just buy dirt. I heard that on the radio once, and that just made sense, she said. So every time I get a new contract, I've bought dirt. Now I have dirt, and I don't have to sing. Jackson continued to perform until the pandemic slowed her down. She worked two shows in 2023, the most she's done since 2019. With COVID, I wasn't going out there in that crap, she said. And frankly, Scarlett, I never did drugs. I only drank red wine and saved my money. So therefore, I didn't need to go to work. It's all right. The next section of the article is titled, The Liquor House. Mildred Jackson was born in Thompson, Georgia, about 35 miles west of Augusta in the rural Briar Creek community. Before she was two, her mother burned to death after accidentally pouring gasoline into a stove, thinking it was kerosene. The stove exploded. Her father, Ty Rufus, a sharecropper, didn't stay single for long. It was just me, my dad, and all them women he married, she said. Since I was a girl, he kept trying to find me a mama. While Rufus was behind a mule every weekday, on the weekends, their home became the neighborhood liquor house. Her daddy made corn liquor, and little Millie happily served it while doing double duty as the house DJ. I was in charge of the music and the corn liquor. Our house was the house, she said. I was just enjoying myself, and the people were enjoying themselves. They came, drank liquor, listened to the music, and they carried their expletive home to get ready for church on Sunday. When Millie was 14, Rufus agreed to help his sister drive to New Jersey, where she was relocating. He stayed there 2 years. I guess he thought he was still driving, said Jackson, who was sent to live with her mother's parents in the home of her grandfather, the Reverend William Bradshaw. I went from the liquor serving house to the Reverend Bradshaw's house, which I really didn't think matched me too well, she said, drawing out each syllable of Reverend for emphasis. You don't go from serving liquor to praying every day. A year later, she ran away to stay with one of her stepmothers for about a year. Then she left Georgia to live with Rufus in Newark. The next section of the article is called A Dare and a Break. In New Jersey, Jackson got a job as a waitress at Schraff's, a once popular chain of restaurants in the New York City area. She went to school at night and tried modeling, once making the cover of Jive magazine. But it was at Harlem's Palm Cafe on a cold December night in 1964 where she got her break on a dare. Lester Young, who had mentored Billie Holiday, was leading the band that night, and Jackson told her friends that the singer was horrible. They bet her $5 that she couldn't do any better. The 20-year-old hopped on stage and sang Benny King's Don't Play That Song. Yes, I too sang with Lester Young, she quipped. Someone caught the performance and invited her to gig at the Crystal Ballroom the following week. She spent her whole paycheck, including the $5 she won on the bet, on a new outfit. Until that moment, being a singer had never crossed her mind. More gigs came. One joint in Hoboken booked her for a month, paying her $15 a night, more than she was making at her day job. She had three songs. She opened her set with All in My Mind by Maxine Brown, followed by Don't Play That Song. Her closer was the spicy version of B.B. King's Rock Me Baby. I played the club for another month, and that was the beginning of it, Jackson said. I ain't stopped yet. Songwriter Billy Nichols remembers the first time he met Jackson. Demo in hand, she visited Sue Records, where Nichols and a bunch of writers were hanging out. She was loud, and she said out of her mouth whatever she wanted to say, Nichols said. That attracted me because there was an honesty in what she was doing and saying. But he didn't think Jackson had the potential for a bright future. I didn't see her as a big star at the time. She sounded like a good singer, Nichols said. But there was a lot of good singers. He would be proven wrong. The next section of the article is titled, A Unique Artist. Jackson and Nichols, who was forging his way around New York as a songwriter, stayed in touch. Jackson invited him to a show in New Haven, Connecticut. When Nichols walked in the club, the crowd was eerily silent. Everyone, including the bartenders and cigarette girls, were staring at the stage where Jackson was talking, not singing. That was when I first realized that she was a star, said Nichols. I had never seen her do that part of her act. I said to myself, all this girl needs is a record. She had her stage act. All she needed was a hit. Once she landed a record deal, Jackson initially followed the stylings of fellow Georgian Gladys Knight. Everyone said we sounded alike, Jackson said. Her first album, the self-titled Millie Jackson, came out in 1972. That was the same year that Aretha Franklin released Young, Gifted, and Black, and a year before Roberta Flack released Killing Me Softly and Gladys Knight and the Pips had the hit single Midnight Train to Georgia. Jackson's first album produced two top 10 soul hits, My Man, A Sweet Man, and Ask Me What You Want, which was co-written by Nichols and became the first of his many Billboard top 20 hits. Despite the song's success, Jackson thought they sounded like warmed-over Motown tunes and too much like Knight. She had to do something different to break out of the pack. That same album featured the socially charged A Child of God, It's Hard to Believe, and was an early example of her Southern blues and soul background. Her second album, It Hurts So Good, dropped 5 months later. The title track was featured in the hit movie Cleopatra Jones and peaked at number 3 on the soul charts. But the stage was where Jackson made her mark. A highlight of her shows was her version of If Loving You Was Wrong, I Don't Want to Be Right. She opened up the song and stretched every boundary, similar to what Isaac Hayes was doing on covers like Walk On By or Aretha with Respect. She talked and rapped about the joys and perils of being in love with the married man and lamented how she couldn't be with him during the holidays despite all she did for him. Capitalizing on those themes, she scored her first gold album in 1974 with Caught Up, a concept album about a woman having an affair with a married man. Side A features Jackson singing from the mistress's point of view. Side B is told from the wife's point of view. More albums followed, some featuring notorious cover art like 1977's Feeling Bitchy, which featured her staring at the camera and licking her upper lip. In 1989's Live, Back to the Expletive, where she is seated on a toilet. Millie is a unique artist that has a special kind of personality, Nichols said. She is herself all the time. There is no deviation from that. That is why her music is not necessarily mainstream, but she is all right with that. In an upcoming memoir, veteran Atlanta drag performer Charlie Brown, who died in late March, wrote extensively about Jackson's influence on him and the gay community. Millie could be raunchy as all hell. I love being nasty, and her numbers went over huge with our gay audiences, Brown wrote in Bitch of the South, co-authored with former Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Richard Elrich. One of the best compliments I've ever received in my life was from Millie Jackson herself, who told me, Charlie, you've probably helped sell more of my records than I have. The next part of the article is called Her Own Manager. Because of the explicit language in her music, radio play became elusive. By the end of the 70s, her record sales fell off. But she remained a sought-after live performer. She traveled the world during the week and came home on the weekends to be with her daughter Keisha and her son Gerald in Teaneck, New Jersey until 1985 when they moved to Atlanta. And because no man or manager ever could control her, Jackson managed her own career. I never saw where it made sense to pay someone 20 to 25% of my gross income to say, she will do the gig. I don't think so, she said. Those fractions don't work. Jackson hired her band, started her own record label, Weird Records, W-E-I-R-D, capital W-R-E-C-K-U-D-S, and booked her tours. To promote her album, Young Man, Older Woman, she developed a popular stage play around it. In 1979, she released I Had to Say It, which might very well have been the first rap song recorded by a woman on a major record label. She even recorded a country album. What I think is great is that she's put herself in a position as an incredible business person to be able to pick and choose what she wants to do, said Keisha, 57. If she doesn't feel like working this year because all the offers are trash, then she doesn't work. And she is perfectly fine with that. These days, Keisha, who looks like her mama, serves as Jackson's de facto spokesperson. She sets up Jackson's interviews and sits in on a lot of them, serving as a context filler. Keisha started singing background for her mother when she was 15 and has released 2 solo albums. But she is best known as a highly sought after and acclaimed session and background singer, performing with Joss Stone, Angie Stone, Faith Evans, Outkast, and most notably, Erykah Badu. She always wanted me to be an attorney because I debate real well. But I was around it so much that singing was a natural thing for me, said Keisha, who is touring with Kenny Loggins on the Yacht Rock Review Tour. The things that your parent almost forbids you to do are the things you gravitate toward. The final section of the article is titled, All in the Family. A week later, Keisha invited me to a video shoot for a new single, On the Floor. Jackson, who has a cameo in the song, would be there shooting her scene. Keisha arrived with Yama Brown and Heather Hayes, the daughters of James Brown and Isaac Hayes. Keisha, Hayes, and Namfuyo Aisha, the daughter of Betty Wright, make up the touring group of Daughters of Legacy. About an hour later, Jackson walked in. The laughing stopped and each paid their respects to Jackson, who smiled and hugged all of the daughters. Then she walked into the studio and delivered her line. When the hell are you gonna get tired of being sick and tired? She nailed it on the first take, but the director insisted on a few safeties. After a few more takes, she smiled and walked off the set. We got it, she said. I'm going home. Back at the kitchen table, I asked Jackson what she wants people to remember about her. She cut me off before I could finish the question and told me she doesn't care what people think about her. Then she paused. But at the same time, she said, the one thing that everybody seems to remember about me is that I say what I feel and I do what I want. And I took care of my kids. That's it. None of that other stuff matters. That was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution profile of Millie Jackson titled Unapologetically Outspoken, Music Legend Millie Jackson. It was published Sunday, April 7th, 2024, and written by Ernie Suggs. The following reading contains words that will be offensive to some listeners. I'm going to wrap up today's African American Hour with a book review. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution book section that was published on Sunday, March 17, 2024. The title of the review is Huck's Companion Retails Classic. This book review was written by Leah Tyler. James, by acclaimed author Percival Everett, retails Mark Twain's 1885 classic Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as experienced by Huck's enslaved travel companion, Jim. As Jim and Huck voyage up and down the Mississippi River, usually together but sometimes apart, Everett's vision of Jim's journey toward freedom is as much a harrowing adventure through the antebellum South as a vibrant depiction of an iconic literary figure tenderly rendered with heart and agency. Everett's brilliant and searing 2021 Booker shortlisted novel, The Trees, is a satirical horror comedy portraying gory ramifications of the 1955 lynching of Emmett Till that was heralded by The Guardian as an act of literary restitution. While Everett employs a gentler approach in James, using nuance and vulnerability to emphasize Jim's humanity, he leaves a similar stamp on the literary landscape as he dismantles the stereotypes of the enslaved humans depicted in Twain's classic. The opening pages of James showcase the first point of difference between Everett's and Twain's Jim character by tapping into a notable aspect of the classic itself, the language. Huckleberry Finn was one of the earliest works of American literature to be written in the vernacular. A proliferation of racial slurs and stereotypical depictions consistently land the novel on the American Library Association's list of most banned and challenged books. Employing a first-person patois similar to Huckleberry Finn's, Everett turns Twain's use of dialect on its head as he shows Jim and others who are enslaved code switch in front of the slave owners to appear less threatening. White folks expect us to sound a certain way, and it can only help if we don't disappoint them, Jim explains to a group of children while teaching a lesson on slave speech. He also educates the children on the psychology required to remain safe, such as never offering a helpful suggestion or appearing to have an idea first. It provides an immersive plunge into the mindset used to survive slavery that is as infuriating as it is effective. As in Twain's novel, Jim is running to avoid being sold and separated from his family, wife Sadie and daughter Elizabeth, and Huck fakes his own death to flee his abusive father. They encounter each other on Jackson Island, have entanglements with the floating house, a steamboat, and two swindlers proclaiming to be a duke and a king, to name but a few parallels shared by Twain's narrative and Jane's. The most notable difference in the storytelling is the stifling, palpable fear that accompanies Jim's adventure. Jim is not running only for his freedom, but his life, and the threat of capture equally foils and fuels his journey. Everett paints a portrait of the realities required to uphold the institution of slavery as Jim encounters a variety of scenarios along the way. There are whippings, lynchings, breeding farms, and rape. But in addition to being a truth teller, Everett is a satirical genius who employs a subtle hand to highlight the absurd. After their raft is busted and Jim and Hook are separated, Jim washes up on the shore and is informed by four black men he's in Illinois, a free state. His hopes are destroyed, however, as the men explain they're still enslaved because the white folks around here tell us we're in Tennessee. None of the satire shines quite as bright as the ridiculousness of Jim being sold to a minstrel show, where he must paint himself white before applying blackface and is put in danger because his wig appears authentic. Jim and Huck are separated a few times, and while Huck goes off and has his own adventures, Everett's narrative follows Jim and occasionally dips into the surreal. While recovering from a rattlesnake bite, Jim's visitation from the 18th century French philosopher Voltaire sparks a debate as Jim pokes holes in the famed abolitionist's antiquated concept of civil liberties. Feverish and unaware that Huck has returned and he is speaking out loud, Jim fails to code switch to slave speech and Huck's suspicions are aroused. Voltaire isn't the only historical figure that makes an appearance in James. John Locke, the 17th century father of liberalism, and a few other prominent Age of Enlightenment scholars provide an intellectual think tank for Everett to challenge how their doctrines allowed slavery to proliferate. But the primary relationship explored in James is the bond between Jim and Huck. Huck is fascinated with Jim and seeks to understand their differences, most notably why Huck is free and Jim is enslaved. Huck is challenged because his natural instinct isn't to perceive Jim as different, despite the messaging hammered into him by the surrounding world. The bond Jim and Huck share goes both ways. After one of their separations, Jim admits he's simultaneously sick with worry over Huck and ashamed to feel such relief for being rid of him. Their relationship proves even more complex once Jim must decide who to save from drowning, Huck or a friend who has offered him safety. Their storyline concludes with a compelling twist certain to inspire debate. In a 2023 Publishers Weekly interview, Everett stated he set out to write a novel about Jim, not about slavery. He happens to be a slave, but it's about Jim, and about what Jim represents in the American literary landscape. As Jim propels toward freedom and a reunion with his family, and ultimately his chosen name, James, it rapidly becomes clear Everett has accomplished more than humanizing a marginalized voice. He has, once again, delivered a seminal work of literary reparation. That was a review of the book, James, written by Percival Everett. The title of this book review was Huck's Companion Retells Classic. It was written by Leah Tyler and appeared in the March 17, 2024 edition of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.